This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. Sorry, we're starting a little bit late. If you're listening live, we were having some technical issues. And if you're listening live, you obviously know that we're at BBS Radio, and we're on Tuesday evenings from 6 p.m. Pacific to 6:55 Pacific, or 9 Eastern, and everything in between. Tonight, our guest is my friend, Gloria LaRiva. Gloria is an activist. She's a union leader. She's a political activist. She's a fierce campaigner for peace, social justice, and equality. And in 2016, she ran for president of the United States with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and here in California for the Peace and Freedom Party. Gloria LaRiva, welcome to The People Speak.
Oh, it's good to hear your voice, Cindy, and thank you for the invite.
It's nice to hear your voice again, and thanks for your patience with our technical issues.
Oh, yeah.
I know you are a super busy person, so we appreciate you being able to take the time with us.
Yes, I'm glad.
Okay, great. So, Gloria, you ran for president in 2008 also, and then you ran again in 2016. 2008 was like the ascendance of Obama and all the excitement of the potential. And then 2016, we had a different situation happening. It didn't seem like very many people were very excited about the candidates for who ended up being candidates for the Democrat and Republican Party. For you, what were the differences of 08 and 16?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I think 2008 was more of an opportunity for socialists to be running in the elections for a kind of a strange reason, because the right wing was accusing Obama of being socialist. Mm-hmm. Of course, he wasn't or isn't. And yet the media would call us, different radio stations around the country, and say, well, you're a socialist. What is it? You know, they say Obama is. Is that true? And if not, what is socialism? So that was the beginning. And then in the presidency of Obama was also at the time of the huge crash, the financial crash, the increase of 3 million foreclosures, you know, economic disaster for people. Pensions were lost half their wealth. At the beginning of a major downturn, which we have not recovered from. So all these 8 years have been, I think, a growing interest in the struggle by young people, especially young people. But I think there's really been an explosion of youth involvement in this last few months since Trump's election. But I think basically things started to change in terms of interest in alternative politics in 2008.
Then we saw in 2012, I ran for vice president with the Peace and Freedom Party. I think saw not even 2% of the national electorate vote for alternative candidates. And I think it was about the same in 2016, where there was a lot of excitement in 2016 for Bernie Sanders. And then we saw, again, not very many people actually turning out and voting third party in 2016. Why do you think? What's your analysis of that?
I think that people during the primary months, millions of people who supported Sanders, especially very young people who, you know, it's the first involvement in politics, I do think that they thought, and they were, you know, in their way, voting for socialism or voting for radical, voting for Bernie Sanders. They saw him as someone completely different from Clinton and Trump and the other 16 Republican candidates, something so ridiculous. I have seen, Cindy, I've been traveling around still after the election and participating in protest forums, getting a lot of contacts from people on Facebook. Mm-hmm. A lot of young people writing me and saying, I want to know about your group. How can I join? How can I get involved? Can you give me advice? A lot of people saying they got involved with Bernie Sanders and became very disillusioned with the whole electoral process. Mm-hmm. Not just what was happened with the conspiracy in the Democrats against Sanders to make sure that Clinton would be the nominee, but also that even with their enthusiasm for Sanders, they see now the trap of the elections and as no way making any change. So that's why I think there's been much more involvement in the last few months. I just came back from New York this weekend. I spoke at a PSL Women's Socialism Conference. I was stunned. Everyone there just about was new and were coming up to me because they'd heard about the campaign. They were coming up and so enthusiastic, very serious people, mostly women, but men too, all just engaged up. So serious and, you know, young people. I'm just floored by seeing that. And they all got involved since the election.
Right. And you and your partner, Richard Becker, came to Vacaville and took me out to dinner, which was very nice. But before you got there, Richard was telling me that the interest in PSL has just exploded since the election. I don't remember the numbers he told me, but it was quite dramatic.
Oh, yeah, I would say explosion. I just finished talking to someone on the phone describing it as that because there are so many people that in a couple of cities we're having to say we have to move out of our office and get a much bigger place. In Chicago, they're having to figure out how to deal with so many people who've come in to join. And they had this March of Thousands this weekend, a women's march. It's visible on the Facebook and YouTube. But this is the kind of reflection of not only people feeling betrayed, first of all, being enthused by Bernie Sanders. I mean, we know the contradictions. He is a senator of 30-something years who voted continually for war and war budgets. I guess one time he was opposed to the war in Afghanistan, but a Democrat, basically, a liberal Democrat, because the Democrats abandoned liberalism since before Clinton. But people did get enthused, and then you can't just stop. You can't just hit a wall and say, okay, I'm done, I'll wait for 4 years. These are young people who really want to fight. That's the qualitative change between 2008 and 2016, or even 2012. As you know, the last 6 years has been Occupy, it was a great start. It was a great window into what could happen in the future. But I think there was a frustration too that it didn't evolve into something more permanent. And I think people are looking for organization now.
Well, I think that in 16, after the primaries and after Sanders, you know, either got it stolen from him or lost or whatever. Sanders told people to vote for Clinton. And, you know, many leading Democrats like Elizabeth Warren and, you know, people who are falsely perceived to be on the left, you know, they said, okay, now we fought against her, but now it's time to work with Clinton to defeat Donald Trump. And so it's nice to see. I think a lot of people did vote for Clinton to defeat Donald Trump. to try to defeat Donald Trump. But right. It's nice to see the level of activism and interest that's happened since November.
Right, and I think the challenge for the left and the progressive movement of all the organizations is to really struggle in these days, weeks, months during the Trump administration to not let the vacuum be filled by the Democrats once again, who will say, you know, what the answer is to elect us in the mid-year, help us win the majority, and then help us win the presidency, because the Democrat Party is historically the great absorber of social movements.
Right.
That fall into that trap. And they're not putting you know what fight they're putting up? Russia bashing.
Right.
They're bashing Trump for Russia. And that's it. No substance. Maybe they'll make some comments in response to the Muslim ban, but no real fight back, because that's not their objective nor their purpose. They're one of the pillars of capitalism in the most powerful, most capitalist country, imperialist country. And so they are ultimately for the expansion of profit, for the expansion of empire. And so they are a dead end, an absolute dead end. I think that the Russia bashing in particular is an absolute cynical move on their part. And it shows a lack of substance on any other in any other front.
Well, of course we see, you know, I've only been doing this since my son was killed, so I don't have the long history you have, but I have quite a lot of experience. And I see the Democrats, they're not, like you said, they're not fighting for single-payer health care. They're not fighting for, you know, fair and just immigration laws. They're not fighting for education. They're just Nancy Pelosi and her ilk and her mob. They're just biding their time, like you said, till the midterms, because she wants to take over. And, you know, I mean, she wants to be Speaker of the House again. The Democrats, they want the Democrats to get a majority. So like you said, they're just kind of kicking back and waiting until 2018 and hoping that they'll take over the majority. And we both know if they do that, then there won't be any substantial reforms or things happening for the working class either, or for peace.
Yeah, and I can certainly understand people feeling we have to get the Republicans out. You've seen the town hall meetings of Democrat and Republican Congress people who came home, and hundreds of people just shouting them down, saying, "Don't you dare get rid of Obamacare," or "Don't you dare attack our rights. Stand up, resist." You know, people were holding the signs telling Democrats, "Resist, resist." And so there, I would say most voters who vote Democrat haven't given up on them yet. And you can expect that they would feel like we can't ignore the races in 2018. The problem is if people stop fighting, or if they don't take up organization and mobilization as the only tactic and the only way forward. I remember the Women's March the day after inauguration. You know that the vast majority of those people had never marched before. And that was a huge development, to see people who realized just by taking a step into the street and marching with others and feeling power and feeling strong and all the other issues that were raised, women's issues and working class issues, that I really think that was an important development. And the subsequent protests that have taken place, we have to keep that up. We have to look back at 2006, when the great May Day March of millions of immigrants took place without rights, you know, the undocumented, no rights, no guarantees, and yet they took to the streets. And then the Democrats and many of the NGO types who said, "Look, now, today we're in the street, tomorrow we vote." Well, most of them couldn't vote and still can't. But the movement was absorbed into the Democrats, who sat on legislation for legalization of immigrants until the Republicans came in. And they were told let us take over now. Now, you see how virulent, how absolutely aggressive the Republicans are right now. They're jamming stuff through, ramming it through, because they have a simple majority in the House and the Senate, along with Trump. So why couldn't the Democrats have done that?
Right.
Not only would they not have lost in 2010. Not only would they not have lost, they would have inspired so many people, but they can't do that.
You would think.
They can't, but they can't do that, because then it means that you're waking up the masses to demand more, to demand more.
Well, one of the most energized and exciting movements I was involved in, and my campaign of 08 against Nancy Pelosi had a lot of energy and a lot of excitement because it was impeach Bush and Cheney. And she refused to do that. She famously said impeachment was off the table when she regained the majority. So I ran against her, and it was very exciting. There was a lot of interest because I'm like you, a revolutionary, and I don't think impeachment would cure capitalism or imperialism at all. But, I think the reasons for impeaching Bush and Cheney were just, and I think that they were very good, sound reasons for impeachment. And then the movement just absolutely died when Obama came in office, because very shortly after he was inaugurated, he continued the policies of empire and capitalism. And there were many reasons to put impeachment on the table for him. So when I talk about Democrats, I'm not talking about the average Democratic voter. I'm talking about the scoundrels in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they just use people. And, you know, that's really why Clinton lost in Pennsylvania, Ohio. What did they call them? The firewall states, the Midwestern states that Democrats had always come to depend on, take advantage of, because they're labor. But this time labor, including Wisconsin, voted Republican because the workers have seen too much economic crisis and jobs lost, and jobs that came back at half their wages, pensions dismantled. And so they weren't, it wasn't a turn to the right. It was a searching for another alternative of someone who was, you know, like a circus, whatever, Trump. But it's also the classic ping pong game of American politics. You try one party for two elections or one, and you go back to the other, and it's just back and forth, back and forth. This was a more intense, more reactionary back and forth or turn to the right. But I don't think it's, I mean, there's a lot of people who are racist. There's people who are emboldened now. There's fascist attacks. There's, you know, attacking Jews and people of color and immigrants. We're seeing all that happening, and we're seeing politicians like that. Congressperson from Iowa, who made that very racist statement about immigrants yesterday. We're going to see more of that. And that's why I was at the Labor Council last night, and one of the leaders in the Labor Council said, the Democrats brought us to this position, you know?
Right, absolutely. Well, I was very pleased that I was able to vote for you in 2016. But we have a question or a comment. A caller, Jay from Delaware, do you have a question or a comment? Jay, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, guys and gals, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
So you got like 1% of the vote. You're running on what ticket? What were you trying to promote yourself on the political stage, or do you think you would do you just want to make a name for yourself and actually you're going to go nowhere?
Jay, thanks for the question. You know, it wasn't to promote myself as an individual. It was to really promote the idea of struggle as the only answer for making change. Historically, in this country and every other country, but let's talk about the U.S., when you look at the past in the last century, the 20th century and this century, the only time that people have made gains, whether it was civil rights, the end of apartheid in the South, the end of the Vietnam War, unemployment insurance, Social Security, it's when the working people and the unemployed, the poor, the students mobilized and demanded their rights, women's rights. You know, women had to march for decades. Women had to sacrifice to demand even to be able to vote. And they came up against this wall time and time again until it was just untenable to keep denying women. The end of slavery, all these things that took place. And so today, in the elections last year, we were telling people that the elections were not going to change. There might be some tactical differences between Democrat and Republican, but the ultimate answer for the people is to organize. And we're seeing the results of that in many young people and people of other ages, too, joining in the movement because they see how things change. Just take one specific example. The fight for $15 an hour minimum wage. No politician, it never crossed the lips of any politician in the U.S., from Congress on down, to ever declare that $15 an hour was the just wage, which is the only kind of minimal survivable wage. It took low-income workers, McDonald's, other fast food, and domestic workers, along with the unions, the service unions, which organized, went on strike at Walmart and so on, and made it a popular issue, so popular that the politicians then had to move in and phase in $15 an hour. Now in California, San Francisco, we're going to have $15 an hour by the end of this year. In other places, it'll be less. But the only people who made it happen was the workers. And that's what we're about, is promoting the movement and the struggle.
Well, and also, Jay, if you're still listening, Gloria is in the streets and going around the world in this struggle with members of the working class around the world. And as somebody who's run for office 3 times, it's really a terrible, if you're a third party, independent candidate, it's an awful way if you want to try to make a name for yourself, because we have to fight against the election laws, the media, you know, all the institutions that profit and are helped by members of the Democrat and Republican Party, which are, like Gloria pointed out, essentially the same. So if you really want to promote yourself, and I know I've spoken to most of the people who run third party or independent, whether they're on the right or on the left. And I really, even though I don't agree with everybody 100%, I think that these are really people who really want to inspire true change in this country. And unfortunately, election, especially presidential elections, are the time when most people pay attention. Gloria, we have a second caller. This is a record for my show. We have Moses Great. From Maryland that would like to ask a question or make a comment. Moses, are you there?
Yes. Gloria.
Hi.
Good to have you on the People Speak radio show. All I keep hearing about nowadays is technology and the automation process. And I know with our growing population, I was wondering if your party or you in particular have looked into the universal basic income to combat the rise of automation due to technology. Oh, my.
That's an extremely important issue.
Yes.
I know that there's a European country, was it Sweden, that's instituted that, sort of a minimal wage for people, even those who are working, to help supplement their pay. I mean, there have been things like that in the U.S., you know, unemployment after you worked, or general assistance, welfare as we knew it then. But the question that you're talking about, a universal basic income, I think about this a lot in terms of, you know, if you're a socialist and you talk about radical change and revolution, then you have to talk about how would we change this country? How would we convince the working class, even before revolution, that by eliminating war production, the weapons, the nuclear bombs, the plastics industry that's just destroying the earth, or other things that are not necessary, like constant new models of cars, how do we switch over production or shut down industries that are killing the earth and then create other jobs? There's a period of time where there's transition and training. First of all, for industries that have to shut down, like nuclear weapons, you have to guarantee people an income, a living wage, an income, in addition to basic things that many people feel they have to make a lot of money, or they're impoverished because they don't have the money to pay for healthcare. Things, those are incorporated, I think, into income that we don't even think about. Complete free universal healthcare for every individual. The right to home. I don't believe that people should have to have a home by paying the bank. I think the banks should be nationalized. I think the foreclosure should end. We have millions and millions more empty new homes in this country, housing units, than we have even homeless people or underhoused people who have to share with someone else or sleep on the couch. We have so much enormous wealth that millions of people could be given an income in the transition to another kind of economy, plus millions of people who can't work. Since the Reagan era, millions literally have been denied disability who really can't work. I live in San Francisco. I walk the streets every day home from work or go to work walking, and I see so many homeless people who I know by watching them, seeing them, they have mental issues. They cannot work. There's many disabled people, older people. So there is, rather than thinking of it as what the Democrats and Republicans like to portray as make work or just giving people money, shelling out money, we're not talking about charity. We're talking about the enormous wealth, untold wealth in our country that has just zoomed upward to the 1%. And they're getting that 1% is getting far richer, the ultra rich, because they're paying us pennies an hour. And you're talking about automation. I just saw recently, you know, we know about automation that's taken place, robots and so on, even McDonald's and Burger King. McDonald's is now instituting, as you see, where you just enter your order and then people just come out to give you your food, but it cuts down on the workers. Or Walmart, where they've had so many workers who do the inventory, or Amazon, super overworked, underpaid, but now they have these robots that will do the inventory and do require 10% of labor that they need now. So what we're seeing overall is the increased impoverishment of the workers, growing unemployment, a mass of people who are no longer needed. You either go to prison or you're in the streets for the only way that you can make money, perhaps drugs or whatever. If you're not formally employed, you'll be informally employed. That's a fact. So, excuse me for a long...
That's interesting.
Excuse me for a long message.
Oh, go ahead.
No, but I always think about this. I say, like, you know, they talk about the North Dakota access, and the politicians are saying, you know, there'll be, like, jobs created. I can tell you there'll be many more jobs created if you put all the young people and construction workers and others, make people apprentices and go build roads, build a bridge, build a building.
Gloria and Moses, we're going to have to take a quick break. So I know Gloria will be back after the break. Moses, if you want to hang on, you can ask your follow-up question after the break. This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to the People Speak Show on BBS Radio. And our guest tonight is Gloria LaRiva. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Come, you masters of war.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. I've been a peace activist since 2004, when my son Casey was killed in Iraq. I've learned since then that achieving peace means more than just being anti-war. It encompasses being pro-environment and pro-equality for all people of all genders, religion, and ethnicities. Please join me at cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com with many other people who believe in working for a more peaceful and humane future.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Yeah, I would like
welcome back to the People Speak with Cindy Sheehan and our guest Gloria LaRiva. And Moses, are you still there?
Yes, I am. And I'd like a follow-up with Gloria. Thank you for your answer. My other question, you brought up drugs. I was wondering if the Socialist Party was for the legalization of all drugs.
And, you broke up a little bit at the very last part of your sentence, your question.
Okay, well, Gloria, well, although I support a universal basic income with the automation, I was wondering if you'd looked into the private ownership of our currency and have aligned yourself with ending the private Federal Reserve System?
Well, I think that the Federal Reserve System is kind of a catchword by some people. It became a very popular idea during the Occupy, especially. I really think it has to do with the whole banking system as part of the capitalist system. The banks have really become the rulers, basically. They run the Treasury Department. They have for years. I mean, you have Goldman Sachs now, whether it was going to be Clinton or Trump. You have the banks ruling over people's lives, and they're the ones who decide whether you invest or not, whether there will be funds for development, and it all goes to, the kind of development that doesn't benefit people. So I really think that the nationalization of the wealth of the banks has to be take place. And the other thing about jobs and income and guaranteed income, and some people can say it's a giveaway or things shouldn't be for free. I'd like to start with Trump, who was given, as a billionaire, he was given $800 million in taxes that the city of New York forgave him because he promised to bring development to New York City. And when you think that if he had to pay taxes, like we have to pay taxes, on just one issue alone, what he owed New York City, there could have been almost $1 billion in development of housing, of healthcare. But instead, he was given a gift that the people themselves had to suffer. The bridges are rotting. And so we have to look at the issue of how the capitalists use rhetoric against us to make it seem like we're asking for things to be given to us. But you look at hospitals, and nurses themselves don't even get health care in the place that they work. Construction workers aren't even guaranteed housing after their job is done. You can actually be homeless after you, if you end up without a job as a construction worker. So what we say as socialists is that all the social wealth that's created by the working class, and only the workers make the wealth, not the billionaires, all of it should be shared in common.
What do you think the result of legalization of all drugs
Moses,
would be on our society?
Moses, thank you for your call, okay? It's my turn to ask Gloria questions now. So, Gloria, talk, and also, you know, here in the United States, we don't start off on an equal footing. And so equality is not, you know, we don't have it here in the United States at all. And some people start, like you said, Donald Trump, start from a much higher place than most of us do. We don't have the same advantages. We don't have the same opportunities that, you know, let's just talk about the Occupy Wall Street terminology that children of the 1% have had. And so you have been a frequent visitor to Cuba. Cuba is a place that is far poorer than the United States. But the things that you talk about, housing, healthcare, education, food, are actually human rights, not privileges for the wealthy. And, you know, we see, you can talk about that, but my two comments are, Cuba has a lower infant mortality rate than the United States does, and it has eliminated childhood malnutrition. So talk about your experiences in Cuba.
Yeah, those are very important facts, and I know you've been there too, and you've been a strong supporter of what Cuba has accomplished, and also speaking out against the blockade, which is still very much in place, the U.S. blockade of Cuba. I mean, imagine in Cuba, they had a lot of homelessness, people living in decrepit housing, and when the revolution took place within a year, what was ruled was that everyone who lived in the house was now the owner. You didn't have to pay a bank. That's how homelessness or the housing crisis was resolved. And you have the finest healthcare, where the reason people are healthy there is because they go to the doctor before they get sick. If a doctor doesn't see you in a year's time, he has to come to your house to take care of you and see how you're doing. That's why the U.S. banned Americans from traveling to Cuba for almost 50 years. It's not
right.
because they were afraid of what we would say. I've been there many times and taken people for the first time, and people are always deeply impressed by the peace in the street, by the fact that the police don't carry guns. Like one young man I asked last year who was a police, he pointed to his hip. He said, "Why would we carry guns? To shoot people?" It's unfathomable to them. I'd like to say something about the drug issue, though. We're suffering from a gigantic epidemic.
Right.
And I certainly think there's the grounds for people being able to use marijuana, you know, either, what do you call it, recreational or medicine. But the crisis of OxyContin, the hydrocodones, the opioids, which then has resulted in a huge explosion of heroin use and overdoses. The overdoses have increased 500% in the last 5 years in this country. And there are articles now newspapers from the Los Angeles Times to the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle and other papers that are doing investigations to show how much money the pharmaceuticals like Purdue, which produces OxyContin, is flooding small towns in the Midwest and South with an untold number of opioids, knowing that people will get addicted and then do whatever they have to do to keep using them. That's a crime. And that's one of the one ways to solve the problem of hard drug use. It's killing families.
Right. Well, then on the other hand, people who really need painkillers are having a hard time getting them because the government is cracking down on legal forms of, you know, painkillers. But, you know, we both know that the CIA is one of the major partners or instigators of the illegal opioid trade in the United States.
Right. You know, it's become very distorted. I know what you're talking about, what you're saying about painkillers, hard for patients who really need them to have them. And it's all distorted when there's a crackdown on the use of them for people who really need them because of this proliferation in the public. But it boils down to the profit motive in the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry as a whole. So I think that the issue is not a question whether drugs should be legalized. I think marijuana is a different thing. I don't think heroin or cocaine or crack or other things like that, I don't think legalizing them is going to solve the problem. I think eliminating the profit motive, jailing the bankers who are laundering hundreds of billions of dollars, documented, put them in prison for helping create so much debt and suffering.
Right. Thank you. I'm thinking of our friend, Lynn Stewart. Was she a friend of yours?
Who?
Lynn Stewart.
Oh, Lynn Stewart. Yeah, she was.
Yeah, she passed away a week ago today. Do you have any thing to say about Lynn and her, you know, our comrade Lynn, not just our friend Lynn, but our comrade who was also a revolutionary. Would you like to share a little bit about her?
Oh, sure. I'm glad you brought her up because we need to honor her life. She did die a few days ago. Lynn Stewart was a white woman who grew up in Queens. And as her story tells, she became a school teacher in the 1960s, and she was also involved in the movement at that time, civil rights and so on in New York City. She became a teacher in Harlem and was just devastated seeing the poverty and the racism. She had never experienced or seen that before. And she told her husband, Ralph Pointer, who's a great man. He was fought for her all these years as her husband. She said to him, I got to do something else. I got to help change the world. And he says, what do you want to do? She said, I want to become a lawyer. So she went to school. You know, they had six children among them. She was pregnant. She entered law school. And she became what many people called her, the people's lawyer. She took on cases that were unpopular, but of people who were the most oppressed, people who were in prison, people who'd been wrongly accused. She had, you know, very famous cases. And she was essentially railroaded into prison for defending someone who'd been demonized in the media. Long story short, but she received a 10-year sentence in, I think it was like 2005. And a whole movement arose around her. And she was finally freed because she had terminal cancer. She had less than 18 months to live, but luckily she lived about 4 more years. And all this time she fought for people, for the poor, for women in prison, for men in prison, who just really didn't belong there. And so we honor her because she was an anti-war activist. She was very principled, and she was a hardworking fighter for justice.
Right, and another thing about Lynn, because I was, you had the honor to know her, and she was so cheerful. I was writing to her while she was in prison, like the Cuban Five. You know, whenever I got a letter from the Cuban Five, from a member of the Cuban Five, they would be almost trying to cheer me up because I was sad that they were in prison. And that's exactly the way Lynn Stewart was. You know, I'd send her a letter and like, oh, I'm thinking about you. I hope you're doing all right. And she'd send me this long letter about her great-grandchild. And, you know, it always started out with, how the hell are you, Cindy?
You're right, she was so funny. She had such a sense of humor, and when she spoke, she had the most marvelous smile and laugh. She was so witty, and she had the best way of talking to people and reaching people. So, you know, that's true though of the political activists, those who've been in prison, like you said, the Cuban Five and Lynn, that they want to make you feel good. They care about you. So
absolutely.
Thanks for bringing her up.
Well, I was hoping that, I thought since, you know, she was involved in that case with Ramsey Clark, and I know Ramsey Clark is a good comrade of yours and Richard's, I was hoping that you had would be able to speak about Lynn, because, yeah, I think that she really deserves all the honor and remembrance that we can give her. So, Gloria, we have about 5 more minutes. Is there anything else? This has been a great conversation, by the way. You said you spoke too long when Moses asked you that question. I recently had a guest where I thought I was pulling teeth to get her to say anything. So it's, you know, as an interviewer, it's really great to have somebody like you that's so articulate and can speak on so many issues.
Well, thank you, Cindy, and I'm so glad to be talking with you because I admire you so much, and the fact that you have this radio show, that takes a lot of commitment to have a regular project like this to help give voice to the people and to give people a chance to hear and to listen, to learn. I think there's, by the way, so much in alternate media that we have to support, including your show, and I salute you. I'd like to say one thing in this few minutes that we have, and that is today's announcement by the Congressional Budget Office, the analysts, who always, their role is to analyze the cost of any pending legislation in Congress. We see how during the State of the Union address by Trump, and I will never say President so-and-so, I just will say Trump.
Right.
But anyway, he said we'll have better health care for more people and cheaper and better. All these superlatives. He's got like about 10 words he uses. Great, super, wonderful, sad, terrible. But anyway, so the plan that the Republicans in the House have drawn up is a disaster. And the headlines in the New York Times, the Chronicle today say 24 million people will lose the health care that they have now. And the cost will go up even higher. And the ones who will hurt the more are the poorer and the older poor. But it's going to be a real disaster. Now, we know that the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, did not cover everybody. It was expensive. But it had some features that even in the Republican plan, they have to keep a couple of them, although they're going to phase them out. If they got rid of everything that was in the Obamacare that was helping people, there would be a rebellion, but they're going to phase them out to trick people. Like they're going to keep the children who are in college until 26 being under the parents' plan. They're going to keep that, but they're going to phase it out in a couple of years and other things like that. But this is a disaster, and it's a complete lie what Trump was saying. That's why last week the Republicans in the White House were attacking the CBO, the analysts, saying that they didn't know what they were talking about, that they didn't have any confidence in them because they wanted to discredit what was surely going to come out about the truth of this new health plan of Trump's. And we have to fight that. We have to fight the Muslim ban. We have to fight the deportations. There's so much ahead of us.
And we still have to fight those wars that have been going on forever.
Oh, yeah.
And they're bringing the troops home.
They're making it a permanent feature, saying we got to add more troops to Syria. When did that war start creeping in with U.S. troops?
Right. What did I just recently read? Something like 650 Marines, and it doesn't seem like a lot, but considering that the U.S. has been, the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia have been funding and supplying and training some of the so-called rebel groups in Syria, I mean, it has been another proxy war.
Yes, and the thing is, whenever the U.S. has to start increasing its military presence or justifying, they will throw out these stories like the White Helmets wins an award at the Oscars, or look at the poor children who are suffering. Well, your bombs are making them suffer. But what they're doing is propaganda pieces to say that the Syrian government's responsible. They'll never tell you that the rebel groups, as you were mentioning, who are supported by the U.S., are killing the population. They're coming in and they're murdering people. They're repressing them. And when the Syrian government has been able to free villages and towns along with the Russian troops, they've been providing food and medicine and care.
Right, right. Well, and this is some of the reason of the demonization of Russia and Putin that began in the Obama administration, because Russia is allying with Syria. And so I think that, you know, anybody who goes up against the United States has to be demonized.
Yeah, that's a tried and true tactic of theirs, because it can never tell you that the wars are for profit and for oil companies and for the military contractors to keep using the weapons that they produce so they can keep making more money. And we pay for it. So if we want to get rid of welfare and free gifts, let's get rid of the gift to the Pentagon and turn it to the people.
And the war profiteers in Wall Street. Well, Gloria, I only have 2 minutes left. What is your website?
Our website is pslweb.org. That's Party for Socialism and Liberation. Web, pslweb.org. You can find all kinds of articles. You can write us. If people are interested in learning more about what we're doing and about the movement in general, we're only part of a much larger movement. It's going to take the millions of people to make change, including people who haven't been involved or newly involved. It's going to take all of us united, all ethnicities, all nationalities, young, old, women, men, transgender, gay, bi, everybody together.
Well, thank you so much, Gloria. And I encourage people to go to the Party for Socialism and Liberation and to Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. And I'd like to thank the engineer, Don Newsom, and my producer, Mike Kim, for helping me with this show. And next week, we'll have John Gold filling in for me because I will be out of town. So anyway, I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The People Speak. Peace out for now.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.